listening to a download from theoutdoorstation.co.uk. Number 456.
Hello and welcome back once again to the Outdoors Station. I hope you enjoyed the recent five-part re-release series from the Cape Wrath Trail from the archives. As you can hear, this flu has finally left the building and I'm back on track with this lovely interview with two bog beauties, Lisa Trollope and Libby Kerr, who in July 2017 set off to attempt the complete Munro round of 282 mountains over 3,000 feet in Bonnie, Scotland, all in record time. Now, before we get into this, though, I just want to thank our executive producer for this particular podcast, Juliet Medforth, who, as I understand it, is an enthusiastic wild camper. Juliet has made a donation towards our running costs for the podcast, and our little way of saying thank you is to immortalise her within these digital walls. And, of course, if you ever want to support The Outdoor Station at any time in such a similar way, you can find the details over on theoutdoorstation.co.uk. But let's get back to the bog beauties. Now, I hasten to say that is their name, not mine, and it refers to their fell running team name. Their website is beautiesandthebog.com. And their lovely catchline is a team of fell running women with a love of boggy adventures. You have been warned.
Lisa and I have been running together since about 2012 when we entered the Rab Mountain Marathon, which is a two-day mountain marathon. And then we've just gone on to bigger and better things since then, really. So a number of mountain marathons, a lot of local fell races, the High Peak Marathon, which, although it says it's a marathon, it's actually 42 miles overnight in the Peak District. We've run Hadrian's Wall over 3 days, self-supported. And then we thought we'd have a crack at the Munros.
And you did this now in July of last year?
Yeah, it started on the 3rd of July 2017.
Was there any particular reason that you chose July rather than May or later on in the year?
I think if we'd had a pick of any months, we'd probably have gone for May, June, July, just because the weather's generally a bit better then and there's a lot less midges. But you're past the time of the year when you, well, hopefully past the time of the year when there's likely to be snow still on the ground. But my work's very seasonal and I was asking for 3 months leave to do this. And unfortunately, May and June is one of our busy times of year. So July was sort of the first opportunity I could escape, which is why we went for July, August and a bit of September.
So give the listeners then a breakdown of your criteria for yourself to be self-supported. And were you going for a time or what was the actual reason you sort of started this project as a whole?
So I think both of us had wanted to do something a bit bigger for a little while, and we went to Hope Valley Film Festival and we listened to a number of speakers, but one of them being Stephen Pike, and he talked about his Munro round. And I think it wasn't really on either of us our radars before then, and it didn't set us off straight away thinking about it, but when we were sort of thinking about adventures that we'd like to have in the future, this sort of got stuck in our minds, especially when we looked up how many women had done a round and a continuous round, and it was very, very few compared to the number of guys, and the record seemed within grasp as far as we could tell. I think the next fastest time was 113 days, but they really couldn't find out very much about that, about the lady who did that. So we started planning, and then my postdoc contract was coming up to an end and Libby managed to get some time off work, and we thought, oh, actually this might go, this we might actually be able to pull this off. So we started putting a bit more thought into it. So the plan was to do all of the Munros in Scotland. So that's all the mountains over 3,000 feet. There's a big list of them, which is now kept by the Scottish Mountaineering Council, and to cycle between them and then kayak any masses of water And sort of following in the footsteps of Hamish Brown, really, who's the first person who did a continuous trip of this type. And he wrote a book which is like pretty, which is pretty popular, isn't it? What's it called?
Hamish's Mountain Walk.
Yeah, so sort of following in those footsteps, but doing it sort of as Stephen Pike did it, sort of to mirror the sort of the male fastest time. And we set ourselves a sort of goal of 80 days, but we didn't really have any idea whether we'd be able to manage that, did we? We planned all the routes, but yeah.
The 80 days actually largely came about because we applied for a grant and it said, how long is this going to take you? And we thought, oh, we haven't thought about this before. So sort of roughly totted up the planning that we'd done and came up with 80 days as a figure, which happened to be pretty spot on. We finished in 77, so we were pretty close. With our finger in the air, guess.
Yeah, and you managed to get 3 months off work, so we didn't have that much longer than that anyway. Yeah. But I don't know how much you'd have been able to push it if we'd have been nearly finished.
are there any rules then for what the self-supported nature should consist of?
So our trip wasn't self-supported in that we weren't carrying all of our own stuff. We had a support van, which we went back to at the end of most of the days. But when we were on the hill, we didn't have anybody guiding us. So it was self-navigated.
Yeah,
the cooling, we had somebody with us. The rest of it was self-navigated, and we were carrying the stuff we needed for that day. Or if we were doing a wild camp, we'd sometimes carry the stuff for that as well. But in terms of, are there any hard and fast rules for a continuous self-propelled Munro round? Not really. There's obviously the precedent that's been set by the people who have done it previously, and we did ours in much the same spirit as other people. One of the biggest contentious issues seems to be the water bits. So there's a Munro on Mull, which is an island, and a few people got the ferry across to Mull. Others kayaked, and we chose to kayak. Unfortunately, we had a day which was very calm and still and brilliant weather for that. We might have changed our mind if it had been really choppy and horrible, who knows. But each person who's done it has had to sort of set the rules for themselves. So we did have quite a lot of conversations about, well, what does this actually mean for us? And do we have to, if we go off course, do we have to go and backtrack exactly to get back onto course? Or could we imagine a trail of breadcrumbs, and as long as we intersected it back somewhere on that trail of breadcrumbs, then that would be fine. So we set our own rules, but in the spirit of the people who had come before us.
So you referred to the course or the route then. You can create your own route between the Munros as you wish, can you?
Completely. And that's actually one of the hardest bits of this challenge, was trying to come up with some sort of logical route, because the Munros are just scattered across Scotland. And this one out on the island really floors you, because it's not the furthest north or the furthest south, but you don't want to have to do that kayak out and back to the island more than once, really. So it's a natural start or end point.
I know that was, well, according to your blog anyway, the part that started you off with a bit of trepidation, as you say, crossing the water there and hoping that it wasn't choppy.
I've done very much kayaking before, so I was pretty nervous about that.
Yeah? So did you kayak both ways?
No, we started on Benmore, on the Isle of Mull. So we kayaked one leg of that. So we started on the island at the bottom of Benmore, and then at the end of the day, midway through the day, we kayaked over to the mainland and then just continued from there. The only other kayak leg we did was across Ben Lomond, which you don't technically have to do, but it cuts out a lot of cycling. But it was another beautifully calm day, and we just hired a kayak and paddled across in about 10-15 minutes, wasn't it, really? It was lovely. A really nice day.
It just avoided a 30-mile or so cycle ride all the way around the lock to get to Ben Lomond and then back again.
Well, looking at your first week, if we can just sort of start in week chunks, if we may. According to your notes, or the notes I've picked up here, you achieved 24 Munros in that first week, which I think is pretty impressive going at the best of times. You're obviously very fit, doing the races and things that you do. How did you feel at the end of that first week? Was your body starting to get weary, or had you attacked it and approached it with the right sort of pacing?
I don't think we were doing too badly. I think we made one mistake in that first week, which was not eating enough. So we had a rest day on about day 10,
day 8, day 9, I think. I can't quite remember. But.
And we spent the day basically constantly eating. I think I ate 7 meals that day. and we learned our lesson that we needed to up the amount of food that we were eating a bit more than we had been. Unfortunately, I'd also come down with a cold at the end of that week, which Lisa was quickly catching. catching off me as well. So we were feeling a bit worse for wear at the end of that week, but not so much from the physical strain of what we were doing, but more from not eating enough and just feeling a bit full of head cold, really.
Yeah, I remember our knees were quite painful as well, which is something that got better over the course of the first couple of weeks. In the first week, we were finding that in the evenings, we'd have to sit there with our legs straight, otherwise they'd be really painful. But that sort of disappeared. I think that's just your body adapting to moving every day. So, yeah, I think it's just a bit of an adaptation process. And we tried to take the first 3 days relatively easy, but then we went straight into those mountains around Glen Nevis, which were two really big days out quite early on. So, yeah. Mm.
And the van that you're using as a base then, were you literally parking up, obviously doing the route that you had to do, coming back, resting there? So was there somebody else taking the van and meeting you on the other side of the range?
Yeah, we had a team of very willing.
So both of Libby's parents took a month off each. My partner took a month off. One of your friends came for a week and my parents came for a week. So between them, they sort of juggled their support shifts between them, but they were absolutely great. I mean, we couldn't have done it without them, because doing linear routes makes such a difference. It cutting off distance, obviously trying to move between the mountain ranges, you don't want to have to start where you finish where you started. So yeah, it was great to have them, and they also picked up bits of shopping for us, and you know, and they're on their days off, I suppose. So sometimes they came out for walks with us, but not so much.
Yeah, I was going to say, I know what it's like when you start doing something like this, particularly in Scotland and attacking the Munros, and I should imagine the shopping bill suddenly started getting bigger and bigger each week.
Yeah. Some pretty funny photos of our shopping trolleys from of our supermarket trips, which were just piled high with cereal bars.
I never want to see another cereal bar in my life. No, actually, that's not true. I can still eat cereal bars, but we ate an awful lot of them that trip.
So the first few weeks then, how was the weather in that, well, finest part of the year, really? Was it pretty good for you on the whole?
It was, yeah, those first couple of weeks, at least. We had some beautiful sunny days, especially the second and third day were lovely. The second day was probably one of my favourite days of the trip, just because the weather was glorious. We were on Skurnan Coriacin and Skurthul, which I'm probably pronouncing terribly. We never really did get the hang of the Gaelic, but you could just see for miles, the views were amazing, and we were in T-shirts, which became a rarity throughout the rest of the trip. We had some days of quite thick clag and fog where you didn't really have the views, but we didn't have too much rain in that first week.
Yeah, it was. I think July was quite nice, really, and then it was really the second half of the trip where it got really, really wet. So, yeah, we had a lot of really nice days in July.
You're listening to The Outdoor Station, sharing the stories of ordinary people and their exciting adventures.
Well, there's 280-odd Munros in the round, and by the end of the second week, you'd achieved 50 of them. How are you feeling at that stage?
Stronger than expected, I think. We're starting to get into the swing of it, and I think just getting over those colds that we had at the end of the first week and starting to feel a bit more positive, and we've got a routine going. We knew what we were doing with the van. We knew how much we had to eat. And it felt like, we just got into the swing of it a bit more.
Yeah, I think we were quite faffy, I think, getting prepared at the first week, and also getting the support, getting used to it as well, sort of learning how much we needed to eat and how much they needed to buy, and sort of how to help us be able to get out of the van quickly. I mean, the van was great, but sometimes when you've got three or four people sleeping in it, it becomes a bit of a shuffle getting ready in the morning and things like that. So that we got a bit slicker when it came to doing things like that, and sort of what we needed to do, getting prepared with the things in our bags the night before. I mean, mostly it was sling your bag in the back and you've got the same things ready for tomorrow, just top it up with food and water. But it depended on what the weather was going to be like, etc. But yeah, I think at the end of the second week, having a few more Munros under our belt made us feel a bit more confident. And I remember at the start not really wanting to talk to anybody about what we were doing so much. Definitely. Because we felt a bit embarrassed that we hadn't done very many yet. And it was a bit, I don't know, a bit different to the normal mountain conversation. But when we've only done 10 Munros, you're like, oh, I don't want to sell it too strongly. But then after we'd done sort of 50 in a couple of weeks, we're like, oh, yeah, we're doing it. This is, you know, this, yeah. I can imagine it actually happening a bit more. So
I think because because this was the biggest challenge we'd ever taken on, we weren't sure ourselves whether we could do it or not. So we definitely had that nervousness about telling people what we were attempting, because it felt like you were promising them something that you didn't know if you could deliver. But by the second week, I was starting to feel a little bit more confident that unless something catastrophic like an injury happened, that we might have a chance.
I can understand not wanting to jinx it by committing yourself, as it were, in a conversation. That's definitely true. But certainly, I think after a couple of weeks, your body really starts to go through a major change and start to get back to its basic mechanics, which I think is fascinating to experience, particularly if you've already started fairly fit as you did as well. The other thing I just wondered, it does, concern some people, but obviously you've got the experience, and I'm not questioning that at all. But how did you feel about the daunting navigation in some respects and getting across some of these Munros and some of the clusters where they're together, and once you're up, and you've got to be very accurate with your navigation?
As you say, we'd done quite a lot of things before that had built up our navigation skills. So we felt quite confident with what we were doing, and we were obviously checking the weather forecast, and we made sure we had all the right kit with us as well, and carried a bivy bag in case the worst should happen, like an emergency one. We also had a number of bits of technology with us, which just gave us peace of mind that if something did happen, we had that security blanket there. So Lisa had a brilliant watch which had an altimeter on it.
Yeah, it was really good.
Which was really useful for just helping us with the navigation, because you know what height you're at as well as where you are. We had an app on our phones which would just give you a six-figure grid reference of your current position, which was a useful backup if you really needed it, and then you could immediately find where you were on the map. And we also had a spot tracker with us, which was a GPS tracker, not a GPS navigation unit. It didn't tell us where to go, but it did link to a website which showed anybody who wanted to go onto the internet where we were, and also had an emergency help button on it should the worst happen. So we could either contact our support crew driving the van, or we could contact Mountain Rescue directly using that. So we had a number of safety nets, but fortunately didn't have to use the spot tracker at all.
No, and it was a bit of fun, really. I think a lot of people really enjoyed watching where we were. We got a lot of really encouraging text messages at the end of particularly long days where people were like, oh, wow, we've been watching you on the spot tracker all day and you did really well. And that was really uplifting sometimes, especially when we had done a long day and we were really tired. So, yeah, it was nice.
But you're right, though. I wouldn't want to be going into some of those mountains without much experience or the right kit, all those safety nets in place, because they can be quite hostile environments.
It can suddenly change on you, can't it? Certainly.
Yeah.
So were there any occasions where you were, I'd like to call it not lost, but slightly misplaced?
Surprisingly, not really. We thought that it would happen a bit more often, and generally it happened at the least, the times when you wouldn't expect it to go wrong, when it was actually a really nice day and we just got lost in conversation and found ourselves sort of heading down the wrong valley or something. But we normally caught it within about 2 or 3 kilometres of it happening and never really had to detour very far. But that happened, 2 or 3 times, I think?
Yeah.
Really not much, but we generally had an eye on it quite closely, because I think we were quite worried about missing a Munro, because what would be worse than doing it and then being like, oh, we didn't actually get to the top of that one. So we were really careful a lot of the time. So, yeah.
Were you running with the map as you would do for adventure racing, sort of with your thumb where you were at any one time? Or did you sort of look at the map, stash it away, then check it in 10, 15 minutes time? What was your routine from that point of view?
We never put it away, really, did we? No, yeah. We just had it out. Yeah. And we had a sort of combination of the waterproof Harvey's maps, which are great. And then we had a lot of the OS maps, which we had in just map cases. And we got through quite a few map cases, didn't we? to keep them dry.
We did a good job of destroying both map cases and maps.
Yeah.
They both took a battering.
Yeah.
While you're actually on the tops, I noticed in some of the videos that you were attending to your social media. Did you find that an intrusion at all into the actual round that you were doing?
Mostly it was really nice, actually, because we got a lot of really positive and supportive comments. Occasionally it was a little bit frustrating that we'd got signal and then we'd have to do a little WhatsApp, Twitter session. But generally it just generated a lot of support, which we found really kept us going. So, yeah.
It was quite funny that we often didn't get signal overnight because we were down in the valley. So it was only on the top of the Munros that you got signal. But obviously the wind was really bad at the top, so you didn't want to stop. So we were joking a lot that if one of us got injured on the round, it would be because we tripped over a rock while we were trying to send a tweet or something like that.
Now, did you meet many people as you were doing this? Did the conversation, or did you have time for a conversation with them?
We met quite a few people out on the hills, which some of them I was surprised at. I mean, obviously you expect to meet people on Ben Lomond and Ben Nevis.
But weekends mostly, wasn't it?
Yeah, even some of the more remote ones we saw people, and then others where you're expecting to, we had the whole mountain to ourselves. And we'd obviously would stop and say hello and exchange some pleasantries, but I did find it odd to try and weave what we were doing into conversation. It didn't feel natural, so we didn't tell many people about it that we met on the hill.
There was a few people we did talk about, and actually some of them became our like sort of biggest followers on social media, didn't they? I was thinking of
the
Cairngorms or a few people that we met, and people who gave us donations to charity just on the hill, which was quite nice as well. So, but only when the conversation sort of naturally went that way, I suppose.
One person I know that you did speak with, which I'm fascinated to know more about in many respects, is Kathleen Murgatroyd, who I understand was the first woman to have ever done the round.
Yeah, she was it. I can't remember what year she did it in. Was it
80s? 1980-something,
early 80s. Yeah, so she was the first lady to do it, and she did it solo, and the second person, she did it solo on a folding bike. I mean, it's amazing what she did, really. And she did it starting quite early in the year. So she was telling us about battling with snow drifts and using ice axes and all sorts of things. We had it a lot easier with our much more lightweight kit hauling around. But we went to go and see her where she lives after our second week, I think, and had a lovely evening chatting to her about our plans and how things were different when she did it. And yeah, she's been just wonderfully supportive through the whole thing, really, and full of loads of really useful advice. And yeah, it was lovely to meet her. She's such a kind and inspiring lady.
And what sort of came from that conversation? What struck you as being so different? Well, probably technology-wise or equipment-wise, really. Well, I know back in the 80s, things were slightly heavier as regards equipment.
Yeah, definitely the technology, which I'd probably expected a bit more. But even there were some things I hadn't thought about, like the food that we were carrying. You can go into a supermarket these days and there's a wealth of pre-packaged food designed to be eaten on the go. Whereas the food that she was taking out with her was a lot of tinned food, because that was the only food you could get in those days, which lasted for the amount of time she needed it to and was transportable. Food wasn't designed to be eaten on the go. So that was amazing to think about, and made me feel very grateful for the time that we were doing this in, and we didn't have as many challenges as she did. She showed us photos of her tent, which was a very heavy looking canvas thick tent, and obviously walking poles weren't a thing in those days, and I was so grateful for the pair of poles that I took with me. They were really lightweight and they really saved my knees on the downhills.
Certainly, that's struck me from some of the video clips that I've watched, that you were both using poles, which is good to see. I think they're a very practical extension for any type of outdoor activity. But a lot of younger people think they're purely for old people like me.
We had some comments like that on the hill, didn't we? What are you doing with poles? You're in your 20s.
So what are your thoughts, having used them now for 80 days continuously virtually?
They're great. Yeah, love them. Yeah, anything long or particularly hilly. Not for sort of short, fast runs, I wouldn't take them on anymore, but we were mostly walking in the end. But I think if we ever did, I know, long ultras with hills in, I think I'd take them. Yeah, especially the stashable ones.
I think for anything where you're going to be out for day after day after day, they really make a difference, because you just can't afford to get injured, and it just saves your energy levels as well. It takes it away from your legs and puts a bit more through your arms. It's quite funny, actually. We've got a photo of us at the start, just doing a bicep photo, and another one at the end, and our arms have got noticeably bigger and more muscular by the end of the trip, and I think that just shows how much strain the poles do take off your legs, and just saved your knees so much on the descents as well. I think we would have been a lot more risk of injury if we hadn't had them with us.
It's so useful for testing the depth of bogs and crossing streams and all sorts of things.
Although that said, we did have quite a few incidents with poles. We managed to trip ourselves up with them, stab each other's feet with them.
To be used with caution sometimes.
Talking about your levels of fitness, you must have, or your friends and family must have noticed a significant difference in you when they joined you for a walk on your first few Munros, as it were, if they were at that time. And then when they joined you sort of towards the end, you must have been steaming up these Munros and leaving them in their wake.
I think we were walking pretty quickly, yeah. But I think most of the people who joined us could manage it for, you know, a couple of days. I think it was more when people tried to join us for lots of days on the trot, they noticed that we'd got fitter, you know, our sort of resilience each day had got, you know, we didn't really slow down even when we'd done sort of 25-mile day the day before. Yeah, I don't know if anyone particularly noticed the difference between the start and the end, but we were going pretty fast. I mean, we say that we walked it all, but we did do it in a very much a running style. We didn't stop for anything, really. We just kept going. We did it fast and light. We were wearing running shoes. And anything that was sort of easy and flat and, I suppose, boring, we did jog a little bit. But we thought that at the start we had intended to run more of it. But when we realised just how rocky the ground is, even when it's flat, there's a lot of really steep up, a lot of really steep down. And we thought that if we weren't saving that much time by running the bits that we were running. So we thought it's easy just to get into your one speed mindset and just like go at that speed. So, yeah.
And again, decreases your risk of injury if you're walking rather than running.
Two things which I know this time of year can be an absolute nightmare. And I'm surprised there was hardly any mention of it at all on your blog. And that was midges and ticks. What are your experiences?
The midges, I think at the start we were like, oh, they're not as bad as you think. And then we had a few mornings where they were seriously awful. And being in the van was pretty good. I think if we'd been camping more, that would have been much worse. And the van provides a really nice physical barrier to the midges. And we got a really good system of being able to kill them in the van. So they tended to go to the lights. So we used the Avon Skin So Soft stuff around the lights and they tended to go there and then die. But we did have a good game of squidge the midge before bed every day. But it was getting out in the morning that was the worst. And we were just talking about it before this, actually. I mean, in general, we got on really, really well. But there was a couple of mornings, fueled by midges, that we had like the closest we came to a falling out. And I think it was just because we were trying to get ready in a cloud of midges and we're both really cross. And so the midges were kind of unpleasant. But yeah, you just got to get on with it, though.
We have quite a lot of midges in the Peak District, or not compared by Scottish standards. But the ones in the Peak, when they bite you, it seems to be so itchy. I found the ones in Scotland didn't itch so much, but the sheer volume of them just made your skin crawl. And you're just surrounded by the swarms of them. You just didn't want to be there. It was so uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And no trouble with ticks then?
We did have ticks.
I think I had four. And you
had five.
Nine between us throughout the whole trip. So not as bad as it could have been. We did carry tick tweezers with us all the time and get them out as soon as we noticed them. But I think of those nine, probably four of them were just from 1 hour walk where we went through shoulder high bracken. Which is obviously a hotspot for ticks. So we stopped after we'd got out of the bracken and did a tick check and, managed to find four between us. But they weren't as bad as they could have been.
Certainly, I just want to mention for our overseas listeners, if you've never experienced the Scottish midge, it is akin to a very fine cloud of extremely small insects. And it's not so much as you quite rightly describe being bitten by them. It's the fact that as you're breathing, they get sucked into every orifice around your face. And you just, it's suffocating, isn't it?
They're just indescribably horrible, I would say. But when we were moving, we weren't bothered by them at all. So you just had to get up, get out and go as fast as you could and then not stop until you were clear of the midge zone, really.
Followed by big black clouds.
Towards
the end of the trip, we had some really terrible weather, and it was one of the thoughts that sort of sustained me that at least when it is thundering down with rain, there aren't any midges.
There is always a little rare sunshine somewhere.
If you have any feedback, questions or suggestions, why not drop us a line to info@theoutdoorstation.co.uk.
Now, let's just talk about gear for a short while. Obviously, you were approaching this fast and light and wearing the appropriate clothing and footwear and stuff. So for people that would like to know a bit more about travelling effectively and lighter. Perhaps you could just go through the type of clothes that you were wearing and, you know, how you felt about them.
Yeah, so most of our clothes we got from Alpkit, who very generously supplies us with quite a lot of things. So generally we're wearing running shorts, technical T-shirt, a long sleeve merino base layer, and then we carried with us a thin synthetic jacket and full waterproofs. We had running shoes on our feet, and then what would we carry in our bags?
Generally had a pair of poles, so they would tend to be the lightweight running poles rather than the heavier walking poles. Definitely have a spare layer or two in there, an emergency bivy bag, just in case one of us did get injured.
They were the sort of foil type, though, yeah. The sort of foil sleeping bag.
Yeah. Actually ended up giving mine away to a woman who had unfortunately broken a leg on the bottom of one of the Munros, so it came in useful to carry. We had a lot of food that we carried with us. Took some water with us, and we also carried a water pump to treat the water with us on most days, just because it doesn't have the same taste that the water purification tablets leave behind
pump
them.
Filter.
Yeah. The footwear then, it was Innovates, was it? Was that right? I saw Innovates on your feet.
Yeah, Innovate gave us three pairs of shoes each, which was really great. So we had one pair of trail shoes, the Rocklite 305, and two pairs of fell shoes, which were the X-Claw 275s. They were great.
Yeah, I'd say, how did you get on with those?
Absolutely loved them.
I'd used
the X-Claws before, and I really liked them. They're designed as a shoe to do ultras in, so they've got a bit more... I don't think padding's the right word, but they've got a bit more support if you're going to spend longer on your feet than some fell shoes have. But they've also got really good tread. They were good on rock. They were good on wet mud. They were brilliant. And actually, one of my pairs I wore for about 70% of the trip because my little toes swelled up partway through the trip, which meant they wouldn't squash into the new pairs of shoes. But the old pair had two holes in the side. So I spent about a month with my little toes sticking out the side of the shoes, out the holes to give them some breathing room. So certainly got the wear out of them as well.
There's been various conversations going on in social media at the moment, as it happens, and people talking about boots versus trail shoes as a way of being safe in the mountains. You've obviously, in your years, had boots and now trail shoes. Would you go back to boots for walking, or are you happy to stick with trail shoes?
I think I'm pretty happy to stick with trail shoes because long distance ultra running isn't very different from walking in a lot of respects. I think if you've got a background of doing lots of fell running, you build up strength in your ankles. And then I think that means it's very easy to transfer out away from boots because you don't really need that extra support just because you've got the experience and your ankles have got very strong. For me now, I find boots sort of heavy and clumpy. I did wear them for a few trips on the round where we wore them when we had to do any bits of scrambling. I think I wore them for the Falconridge and then on the Coolin and then maybe one other day. But generally I'm quite happy to wear fell shoes most of the time. The real difference is that your feet get wet. But when you're likely to go in over the top of your boot anyway, into puddles or bogs or whatever, then I guess you're carrying lots of extra water around if you wear boots. But I think that's possibly, you know, it's personal preference. I much prefer these shoes now. So yeah, about you?
I think I'm a fan of the trail shoes as well. It would depend a bit what I was doing. If I was going to do a walk which was predominantly on very rough rock like the Coolin, and the Gabbro rock is very hard on thin, more lightweight materials, I might consider wearing boots. Or if I wanted to try and keep dry feet, but generally I'm a fan of the trail shoes as well.
Now, you mentioned the Coolin Ridge several times there, which is on the Isle of Skye, and I'm actually going up to Skye in May this year, not to do the Coolins, but I would be interested in hearing a description from you what it's like to cross the Coolin Ridge, because I've heard so many stories, and I know you had a guide with you and somebody that was doing the safety part with the ropes and so on, but I'd be fascinated to hear your thoughts on the actual ridge itself.
Oh, it's amazing. I think we were both a little bit scared of it beforehand, just because it does have a bit of a reputation. And we had planned to do it in one go just because it looked like there was a small weather window. It was surrounded by a few days of rain and there was this one break. So we thought we're going to have to do it in one go, which made it a very long day for us. We were out for about 20 hours. We've both got a background in rock climbing, so we didn't find it technically difficult. I know some people who are doing the Munros find it a bit of a stopper because there is some proper rock climbing in it. We didn't struggle with that too much, but the exposure gets tiring. It's never too bad at any one point, but when for 20 hours you're just solely concentrating on where you're putting your feet and just being that bit more careful, you might get mentally tired so quickly. But the views from it were absolutely stunning. The whole thing was just really interesting, really, really cool bits of rock. It was a brilliant day out.
It's an achievement in itself. I think that's what we felt as well, that it was like a mini achievement within the whole round. So, yeah, it was great.
And the guy we had with us, it wasn't an official guide. He's a friend who had done the ridge before, but that was really nice as well because it was somebody we knew and a friendly face to have along.
I knew it was tough. I didn't realise it was a good 20-hour walk.
If you do it in one go, yeah, it's about that.
Silly though, isn't it? You read the record, and now having done it, I'm like, how on earth do they get across it that quickly? I would not be running up there, that's for sure. Really sure-footed people, I suppose.
So there you are, you've done the Coolin Ridge. How long was it between that and actually finishing?
It was about 2 weeks after the Coolin that we finished, yeah.
And was it sort of a downhill feeling after that? Was that a sort of a turning point that you knew you were coming to the end? How did you feel?
It was a bit of a mix. So I think the Coolin really took it out of us, both sort of physically and mentally. And also the weather got really bad after the Coolin. So we had basically 2 weeks of solid rain, and we were having these really difficult decisions towards the end. Like, do we keep going and try and get a few more days in when the weather forecast looked terrible for sort of the next 5 days? We're trying to decide, do we take a rest day now? Do we just push through it? So that was quite hard, actually. I think we found that pretty difficult. We knew that the bulk of them were done though. So it was, yeah, we knew we didn't have that many left to do. So that was sort of, it was just weighing up those decisions, I think. Yeah.
I think I expected it to feel a bit like the home run after the Coolin, 2 weeks to go and a bit more cycling, which is nice to break up the running a bit. But that weather just hit us when we were down. I think the 20-hour day meant that we were a bit down on sleep as well and just feeling a bit battered, really.
Yeah, it was hard.
It was just every day, it's hard to describe, you looked at the forecast and it was 50-mile-an-hour winds with heavy rain and occasional hail.
The wind chill as well.
Got drenched. We had really good waterproofs on, but it came in down your neck. It came in down your sleeves because you had your arms uphill when you were using poles. So it just ran down your arms. And we had several days where we had to just strip off on the hill, change every clothes we had on underneath our waterproofs, put the waterproofs back on. And it's hard to dry things out in a van.
Especially when it's wet for days on end. We did have a few nights in YHAs actually towards the end because we just needed the drying room to get our kit dry again. So
a lot of the days putting on yesterday's wet clothes again and leaving a very smelly van behind.
Yeah. Well, at least you weren't camping. That's gone on the bright side.
That's true.
Completely.
And of course, there was the restorative power of a warm shower in a YHA as well, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
Oh, yes.
And being able to use an oven, you know, and cook vast quantities of food. And yeah, no, it's good.
So I can imagine then the last day, the families and friends joined you as you climbed?
It was just a friend's parents who were in Scotland doing Munros anyway, and then our support, who was our friend Jim. So it was five of us on the last Munro. But it was amazing. After 2 weeks of rain, we suddenly saw the forecast and it's like mainly dry, no chance of rain. And we're like, what? So it was, we'd been dreaming about it, sitting on the top of Ben Hope celebrating. And we were just sort of thinking, oh, this isn't going to happen. It's going to be like one of these other horrible foggy ones and we're going to touch the top and then run away. But actually it was beautiful. And we did, we sat up on the top for sort of half an hour, 45 minutes with a bottle of bubbly and some chocolates, really enjoying it. So yeah, it was amazing.
Well, as they say about Scotland, it's four seasons in one day, isn't it?
That's completely true, yeah.
Well, that's fantastic. You've done exceedingly well, obviously. A great trip, a great story. I should imagine you were so strong and fit by the time you finished this. How long did it take for your appetite to return to normal? The portions to reduce?
Portions were okay. It was more having three actual meals rather than just grazing continuously, I think.
Yeah.
That was the hardest thing, I think. But it didn't take that long. No.
Yeah. I went on holiday for a week when we finished to South Italy and ate everything in sight. It was nice to have an excuse to do so because the food was just brilliant. I was helped by going back to work and having that routine to get back into really changed my mindset. And I didn't find it too hard to adapt back to normal levels, actually.
And talking about mindset, did you find looking at life was slightly different at all when you were to both return to work after this?
Ooh. I think I felt a bit refreshed. Before we went on this trip, I felt I very much needed a break away from the normal sort of 9-to-5 office job. And I definitely got that. And actually, I went back and sort of appreciated having a dry roof over my head and central heating for a while. So I definitely felt refreshed. I'm not sure if it's changed my outlook on life so much.
Yeah, I don't. Yeah, for me neither. I don't. Definitely, it was a really awesome experience, and coming back home and being dry and warm all the time, and you know, being able to go for a run and it be flat, it was just, yeah, really nice. But I actually really missed it, I think, to begin with. It was just, oh, I'm not in the mountains anymore. I just wanted it to carry on, really.
I think the other thing it taught me is just what a fantastic country we live in. I mean, you think of going on holiday and I almost instantly think of going abroad and flying somewhere, but it was brilliant to spend 3 months in Scotland. That's got so much to offer, so much amazing scenery and so much variety. I just think we're really lucky to live where we do.
Well, thank you very much for your time this evening. As you know, if you've listened to some of my podcasts before, you know what I'm going to say now. Of all the things I could have asked you, what should I have asked you?
I think the question I was dreading from you, I think you mentioned in one of your emails that you sometimes... often when you're walking, you get a song stuck in your head. And for us, we got a lot of songs stuck in our head. And one of our favourite things to do to keep ourselves entertained was to change the lyrics of the songs to match our surroundings. I feared you were going to ask us to give you a rendition of one of our favourite Munro songs.
I'm in your hands.
Oh, you didn't ask, so we couldn't possibly.
And on that note, see what I did there? Oh, well, never mind. We forgot to mention, in the process of achieving this particular record, they were also raising money for several charities: WaterAid, Parkinson's UK, and Lockerbrook Farm Outdoor Centre. Their Just Giving page is still open, so if you've enjoyed this podcast and would like to reward them for their efforts, do pop along to justgiving.com/teams/Munros2017. But of course, all the links to their website, photographs, the Just Giving, etc., etc., can all be found over on theoutdoorstation.co.uk under the podcast number. Now, that just remains for me to thank the Bog Beauties, Lisa Trollope and Libby Kerr, once again, and of course our special executive producer, Juliet Medforth, who no doubt is inspired by these like-minded, inspirational women who like boggy adventures. Until next time, folks, bye for now.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To hear or see more from our extensive free library, please visit theoutdoorsstation.co.uk.